Captain, the bioforms have broken off, sonar reported. The captain joined the chief at the sonar station.
Probably sensed the benthos and decided we were a little too big to mess with, the chief suggested.
Maybe. How close were we to the Prometheus when they broke off?
Just under a kilometer, sir. But their last recorded speed was 22 knots. Whatever they wanted to get to the Prometheus before we did.
Agreed. Notify me when the sub docks.
He turned to Terry.
Mrs. Taylor, why don't you join me upstairs in the observation room? We'll watch the Prometheus as she returns.
Still a bit shaken, Terry followed the captain up the access tube's ladder and onto level A. He sealed the hole behind him, then moved to the bar.
Drink?
She nodded. He poured her a scotch, then activated the mechanism to retract the outer titanium dome. Terry drained her glass as the heart of the Mariana Trench opened before her. The Bentha soared majestically through the netherworld like an abyssal blimp. Somewhere below, unseen hydrothermal vents spewed blue-black mushroom clouds of searing hot mineral water at them, directly from the furnaces of hell. Enormous patches of spaghetti-like tube worms danced through the undulating waves of heat. Directly ahead, a patch of sea shimmered luminescent blue as a school of deep-sea bioluminescent jellyfish made their way through the canyon. Terry stood mesmerized as a plethora of orange, red, and purple objects flowed past the window in every conceivable size and shape. The captain pointed to a ghostly, translucent blue figure that resembled a screensaver pattern more than a life form.
Those are called Kiyohimiya. I'm told they're a species of tenafol named for a mythical Japanese princess. Bizarre, aren't they?
Beautiful. And those? Terry asked, pointing to a shimmering blotch of bright orange.
Deep ocean herbivores. They're actually translucent, but the ship's red light gives their mucus filters an orange glow.
They're wonderful.
And dangerous, the captain said.
He refilled her glass.
Sergei is not one to trifle with, especially when he's drunk. You'll be safe in the bridge and in your quarters, but don't venture below E-deck. I'm sorry, I wish there was more I could do to protect you. I may be captain, but this is Benedict's ship. We live by his rules down here.
He stared into the abyss.
Look, here comes the Prometheus.
A flash of lights, and then the white cigar-shaped sub appeared, moving in surreal motion through dense clouds of rising smoke. They watched the vessel descend beneath the benthos, disappearing from view. Moments later, a metallic ring reverberated around the ship as the submersible docked into place.
Captain, those objects chasing the Prometheus, did they also attack the Proteus?
I don't know. Yes, it's possible.
Possible?
Terry moved in front of him, forcing him to make eye contact.
Look, I don't know what they were, only that they hunt in packs.
Why is Benedict so quick to risk his life and those of his crew? I know it's not just to deploy the Eunice robots. What's the real mission? What's out there that's so damn important?
He's uncomfortable. He wants to talk, but he's scared.
It's not my place to discuss our...
Frightening our guest, Captain.
They turned to see Benedict climbing up through the access tube.
Just sharing my opinions.
The emerald eyes flashed a warning signal.
Quote homines tot sententiae. There are as many opinions as there are men. Don't allow our captain's opinion to sway your scientific objectivity, my dear.
What was it that was after the Prometheus, Benedict? Benedict seemed to ignore her, moving to stand before the bay window, his back to them. A 6-foot eel-like creature came into view. Jet black, it slithered its elongated body against the dome just above Benedict's head. Terry stared at the creature, which trailed an iridescent bulb attached to its lower jaw by a long antenna.
A black dragonfish, Benedict said, moving his fingers to and fro across the glass.
The creature stared at his hand with its translucent eye, then opened its jaws nearly 180 degrees as it tried to bite down upon the barrier, displaying row upon row of needle-like teeth. Benedict seemed to relish the performance.
Lovely, isn't it? Are we still on Earth, or have we traveled to an alien world? Is there a difference? Like futuristic astronauts, we journey through a hostile environment, kept alive only within the fragile confines of our vessel. We are the true explorers of our century, delving into the unknown, facing death at any moment. The 7 miles of sea above our heads might as well be 7 light-years, eh, my dear? For who could possibly rescue us in a real emergency?
Benedict turned to face Terry.
You ask me what is out there. My answer is the unknown. We know more about other planets than this parcel of ocean that has remained unchanged for hundreds of millions of years. Yes, Terry Taylor, there are undiscovered life forms living in this hellhole. Some are beautiful, others frightening, as our captain would tell us, yet all have survived the ravages of time while remaining confined within this glorious purgatory. I cannot tell you what is out there, but as scientists and explorers, I know it is our duty and our mission to learn.
How many lives must be lost in that mission? Terry asked.
I take it you are referring to our four departed souls lost on the Proteus. I believe your report to Jamstek indicated the vessel imploded due to a piloting error.
What about those life forms chasing the Prometheus?
What about them?
Don't play mind games with me, Benedict. It's fairly obvious that whatever chased the Prometheus could have also destroyed the Proteus.
And you can prove this?
The statement caught her off guard.
No, but had I known... Had you known what? That undiscovered life forms may exist in the abyss that could threaten our lives? Didn't your husband prove that years ago?
Yes, which is precisely why the United States and Japan have been hesitant to allow other groups to explore the trench. If Jamstek suspected that the crew of the Proteus was killed,
they'd be obligated to inform the Americans, who would order an investigation and delay the mission for months,
Benedict finished.
Knowing what you do now, do you wish to change your report?
No, I didn't say that.
Then what are you saying?
Terry rubbed her forehead. I guess what I'm saying is that I just don't want to be lied to anymore.
Lied to? You accuse me of lying?
I think everyone aboard the Goliath and Benthos knew these creatures attacked the Proteus. I believe you altered the sonar records so I'd provide Jamstek with a clean accident report.
Then it was you who lied.
What are you talking about?
Come, my dear. Which one of us is playing mind games now?
Benedict turned to face her, his glittering eyes mesmerizing her as headlights paralyze a deer.
If you suspected that the sonar records had been doctored, then you lied to Jamstek. And do you know why?
No, she whispered.
Because the outcome justifies the deed. Like it or not, you and I are cut from the same cloth. Two explorers who have descended into hell to complete a mission, your mission. You asked me how many more lives must be lost, and I say, as many as it takes. Would you ask a general at the dawn of battle how many men must die for victory to be secured? The hazard of war is uncertain. Yes, four good soldiers perished under our watch. But are we not here risking our own lives so that thousands more might survive? Pro bono publico, for the public good. Wasn't that the purpose for creating the Unus Array?
There's a difference between acceptable risk and foolhardiness, Captain Hobbs said. You're sending the Prometheus too far ahead of the Benthos.
Benedict gave the captain a long, hard look.
Et tu, Breston? Do you question my judgment?
What I question, sir, is your need to complete a 6-month mission in 60 days. What I protest is your willingness to place the crew in danger.
Benedict turned to Terry and shrugged.
They condemn what they do not understand.
You may quote your Latin at me, sir, but I still maintain my belief that you are taking unnecessary risks.
And you, Captain, are a coward, Benedict snapped. You allow your emotions to whittle away at the foundation of your character, until there is nothing left but fear. Did Columbus delay his journey, or return to Spain upon hearing the first mutinous whispers among his men? Did Lewis and Clark cancel their expedition after sighting their first grizzly? Did NASA cancel the space program when 7 lives were lost aboard the Challenger?
He turned to Terry.
You and I are explorers. We push the extreme and refuse to yield to misfortune, for we know that fortune favors the bold. We cannot bring back the dead, but we can honor them with our triumphs. I know you feel this in your heart, for your own brother died in these waters, did he not?
Yes, she whispered.
If he were still alive, would this noble explorer have turned in fear at the first sign of danger, or pursued his course of action, ever the more determined?
He'd have continued on, she whispered, hot tears welling in her eyes.
As would I. And I shall not allow the deaths of our compatriots to be in vain. We shall press on into the unknown, prepared in mind and spirit to face the challenges that await us. Are you with me, madam?
Yes.
Then join me now. Captain, order the crew of the Prometheus back on board the sub immediately.
So soon? Sure, at least allow whatever life forms may be out there to vacate the area.
No, Captain, I will not allow man or beast to dictate the timetable of my affairs. He who does not advance loses ground. There is much work to be done, and we are already far behind schedule.
But sure.
Benedict moved close to the captain, the two men's noses almost touching.
You have your orders, Captain.
The emerald eyes displayed menace.
Question me again, and I will have you permanently relieved.
Aisha. Benedict turned to Terry and placed his arm around her.
Come, my kindred soul, he said, leading her toward the companionway. The unknown awaits.
Deep Terror. Tanaka Oceanographic Institute. Masao Tanaka stood before the bay windows of his office, feeling the tightness return along the side of his neck. Crumpled within his fist was a fax he had just received from the Goliath, informing him that his daughter, against his wishes, had entered the Mariana Trench nearly a week ago.
How could I have allowed her to remain behind with Benedict?
He massaged his neck, staring out across the dark blue surface waters of the canal. At the end of the waterway, between the two concrete seawalls, floated an immense barge, on top of which stood a mobile construction crane, towering 100 feet in the air. A thick steel cable trailed from the crane's boom and disappeared beneath the sea. A dozen local reporters and their camera crews had gathered along the seawall and western bleachers. Two news choppers circled noisily overhead. Masao watched as a half-dozen scuba divers emerged from the canal and climbed aboard the barge. Moments later, the cable grew taut as the hydraulic winch began retracting it from the sea. For a while, it appeared that the submerged object might win the battle. Then, a massive wall of steel rose majestically out of the sea, the lower section of which was mangled beyond recognition. Masao stared at the battered canal door. He tried to imagine the relentless pounding the creature must have delivered to have caused such damage. Feeling dizzy, he returned to his desk and fell back into his chair. A strange numbing sensation began traveling up his left arm. He felt short of breath. And then a vice gripped his chest, and he fell sideways onto the floor. Mariana Trench. Legs quivering from adrenaline and her overwrought nerves, Terry made her way through the pressurized docking chamber of the Benthos, then carefully down a ladder and into the Prometheus. Benedict followed her, placing a fatherly hand on her shoulder.
Relax, my dear. We'll be fine. Come, we'll find you a seat at a station that has a window. I'd invite you to sit in the observation pod, but Yvonne Krohn, our robotics expert, needs to operate the mechanical arms to prepare a burrow in the seafloor for the next UNIS system.
He led her through the cramped bridge to a computer station situated against the mid-starboard side of the sub. A 6-inch window made of reinforced Luxan was to her right.
Watch from here, but again, touch nothing, Benedict warned.
He left her to speak with the sub's captain. Terry felt as if the sword of Damocles were hanging over her head. She looked into the faces of the Prometheus crew, shocked to see so many expressions of fear. She realized that many of these men, like her, had simply been brought on board to do a job. They were not soldiers at war, and they had not signed on with GTI to foolishly risk their lives. Here they were, 7 miles beneath the Pacific, as helpless as sheep being led to the slaughter. Something was waiting for them out there, something large enough to have destroyed the Proteus. Yet, despite the obvious danger, despite the fact that 4 of their comrades had already died, none would step forward to challenge Benedict's decision. Terry stifled a scream as the submersible pushed away from its docking sleeve. Pressing her face to the window, she stared into the abyss, her heart pounding furiously. Why had she again allowed herself to be manipulated by Benedict? The sub lurched forward. Terry gripped the armrests of her chair. A distant memory came flooding back to her. She closed her eyes and remembered a time long ago when she had been a teenager, flying alone aboard a commercial airliner in stormy weather. At 35,000 feet, the Airbus had tossed about violently, unable to climb above the storm. Every bump, every sudden dip in altitude had caused her to squeeze her eyes shut and grab onto the armrests of her seat. She had felt helpless, alone, and vulnerable, as she and those around her prayed that the fragile vessel that held them would continue to perform in the face of Mother Nature's fury. Without warning, a bolt of lightning struck the plane. All power shut down, every light within the cabin extinguished. For a terrifying, surreal moment, there was absolute silence. And then the plane fell from the sky, plunging nose first, and Terry and the other passengers screamed and screamed and waited to die like helpless sheep, until a higher power had intervened and the engines miraculously restarted. It would be years before Terry would board another plane. Then, when she was 21, Masao pushed her into taking flying lessons. understanding that technology had removed her fear, and she had gone on to become an outstanding pilot. Terry opened her eyes, beads of sweat trailing down her face. Almost 20 years later, the memory still jolted her. She recalled the scent of her father's cologne as he had embraced her tightly in the airport. She heard the sounds of passengers weeping as their loved ones greeted them. But most of all, she remembered the expressions of desperation and terror that had been lodged in the passengers' faces just before the plane had fallen from the sky. Terry realized it was the very look she now saw on the faces of the crew of the Prometheus. When it came to the sea, Terry had never known fear. Like her older brother, DJ, she loved the adrenaline rush of piloting a submersible. The deeper, the better. At one time, she had actually fought with her father to allow her to pilot the AG-2 into the Mariana Trench. Now, everything had changed. And yet, everything felt the same as it had 20 years before. Once again, she felt helpless, a passenger aboard a vessel, this time vulnerable at a depth of 35,000 feet.
"Sorry, miss. Mind if I squeeze in here?"
Terry opened her eyes. A tall, real thin man in his late 20s was leaning over the computer station before her. "I'm sorry." She stood, allowing the technician to take her seat.
"Only be a minute or two," he said,
booting up the computer. She glanced over her shoulder as the screen lit up. A menu appeared below the GTI symbol. She scanned the list. Tokamak. The menu disappeared as the technician typed in several commands, pulling up a navigation chart. He copied several coordinates onto a small clipboard, then shut the computer down.
"Thanks," he said, returning to his station.
Terry sat again, staring at the computer, her fear momentarily replaced by curiosity. A wild idea crossed her mind. She dismissed it, tucking it away for later. The submersible increased its speed, moving silently along the canyon wall. Terry peered out her window. Unlike the Benthos, the exterior lights of the Prometheus barely cut through the blanket of darkness surrounding the vessel. A dull patch of light coming from beneath the sub illuminated the seafloor, revealing a landscape of deep gray. They passed over a cluster of clams, all snowy white, lying in great lines along the bottom. Every so often, an albino lobster or crab could be seen scurrying about, appearing almost translucent within the beam. But in every other direction was total darkness. Terry felt strange, as if the abyss were closing in upon her. She broke into a cold sweat, her hands shaking out of control. She began hyperventilating, and on the verge of screaming, she turned from the window and stood, positioning her face just below one of the air conditioning vents above her head.
"Feeling a bit claustrophobic?" Benedict asked.
She shook her head. I just can't believe we actually allowed Jonas and my brother to dive to these depths in a one-man sub."
"Ah, yes, the great Jonas Taylor. Your husband was once quite a pilot. Alas, the pressures associated with the abyss can steel the nerve of even the strongest men. Try facing a 60-foot great white shark in these waters, and we'll see how anxious you'd be to dive again."
Benedict smiled.
"It seems I've struck a nerve. I assure you that I have but the highest regard for Professor Taylor, especially in light of his most recent interest in my protégé."
"Excuse me?" Terry felt her blood boiling. "Are you purposely baiting me?"
"I don't understand," he said, feigning innocence. "Celeste has informed me that your marriage is all but over."
"Your concubine is misinformed. Jonas and I may have had some problems, but we'll resolve them."
"Of course you will. I'm sure her newfound relationship with your husband is purely platonic."
"As I told you before, I trust Jonas. I know he loves me.
You don't need to convince me. Marriage can be a difficult partnership to maintain, especially when faced with the sort of stress the two of you have had to endure. No doubt the last several years have been difficult. As I recall, you gave birth to a stillborn. A tragic experience that leaves a mark on even the strongest of marriages, I should think. Pain like that simply doesn't go away, does it, my dear?"
Terry gripped the rail above her head, her knuckles turning white. She recalled the image of her doctor's face as he had informed her, 4 weeks before her due date, that her baby had died in her womb. Jonas had been consumed with guilt, blaming himself for the emotional burden he had placed on her, and Terry had done nothing to ease his pain. She focused on Benedict's bizarre emerald eyes, trying her best to stem the rising tide of emotions. Benedict leaned closer.
"You know, some women were simply not meant to bear offspring. My own mother, for example, died giving birth to me. A miracle she lasted that long. I'm sure Jonas was heartbroken at your inability to carry the pregnancy to term.
He smiled.
Now, Celeste, on the other hand, has an inner strength. Stop, please. One day she'll bear children, of that I'm certain.
She felt herself losing control, exhaustion getting the better of her. Tears streamed down her face.
Ah, but I envy the man who claims her as his own. She's a prize, unlike any woman I've...
Shut the fuck up!
Terry shrieked. All heads turned, eyes staring at her, as if she were standing before them stark naked. A triumphant look appeared in Benedict's eyes, the corners of his goatee quivering slightly as he suppressed a smile.
Sir, the captain interrupted, we've reached the location we were forced to abandon earlier.
Benedict's eyes continued unraveling Terry's willpower.
So, shall we resume excavating the location for the next Eunice?
He asked her, as if nothing had happened.
God damn you, Benedict. The crew of the Prometheus awaits your orders, Taylor-sama.
Do it,
she snapped, pushing past him to move into the stern. She located the bathroom and locked herself inside. 10 minutes passed before she calmed herself. She stared at her reflection in the tiny square of mirror taped to the barren bathroom wall. Tears had left her almond eyes swollen red, her jet-black hair disheveled, her bangs matted to her forehead from perspiration. Terry felt the vessel reverberate beneath her feet as the Prometheus began preparing a hole within the seafloor.
All right, girlfriend, she said aloud. Time to toughen up. From now on, you're stone. Nothing gets to you anymore, nothing. Benedict and his Russian asshole can go screw themselves.
Terry washed her face, then pulled her hair into a tight bun. A large 7-foot-tall aluminum locker stood to her left. She opened it, removing a roll of paper towels, drying her face. Then she left the bathroom, and instead of returning to her seat, headed for the observation pod. Ivan Kron, one of Benedict's personal staff, was seated within the spherical pod, manipulating the robotic arms. Terry could see a long titanium tube originating from somewhere beneath the sub, running down to the seafloor 10 feet below.
What is that, a vacuum? Terry asked.
The technician ignored her.
Hey, comrade, you deaf or what?
The man looked up, rage burning in his eyes. Benedict joined her.
Is that a problem?
Your man down there doesn't seem to want to answer my questions.
Since I'm still an officer of the Tanaka Institute, I think I have a right to know what's going on. Benedict smiled at the girl's sudden show of strength.
But of course. What would you like to know?
It looks like that tube is sucking up sediment from the bottom.
That's correct.
As you know, each of your Eunice robots must be buried into the trench floor in order to monitor seismic activity. The vacuum is infinitely more efficient to complete this task than the sub's robotic arms.
A screech of metal filled their ears as the Prometheus was jolted sideways.
Report!
The captain ordered.
Nothing on sonar! Engine still online, Captain.
It was the vacuum,
Ivan called out from within the pod.
It caught on something buried beneath the sand. Feels heavy.
Can you free us?
The captain asked.
Not without tearing the vacuum loose.
Which is not an acceptable option, Benedict said.
Ivan, if we move closer, can you extract this object using the robotic arms?
I'll try.
The Prometheus descended to within 4 feet of the seafloor. Ivan extended the two robotic arms away from the sub, the claws digging into the seafloor like a giant crab. The noise rattled the ship, the echo reverberating against the canyon wall. The 46-foot reptilian creature hovered along the pitch-dark seafloor as her brood chased their prey in her direction. Sensing movement, the big female closed her luminous eyes to conceal her presence. The giant squid swam into range, its 8 stout arms and 2 tentacles reaching out as if groping the darkness. With the synchronized downstroke of her 4 appendages, the big female lunged upward, snapping her flat jaw shut upon the arrow-shaped mantle of its prey. Immediately, the 2-ton squid's tentacles latched onto its larger assailant, the sucker pads and tooth-like rims tearing at the scaly reptilian hide. A life-and-death struggle began, the 2 titans rolling over and over one another. But Architithus was no match for the big female, whose T-Rex-sized teeth tore the life from the giant squid in a crushing embrace. The 3 smaller creatures quickly appeared, ravaging what little remained of the carcass. A length of tentacle still dangling from its mouth, the big female paused in mid-bite. Familiar vibrations beckoned from the darkness ahead. Finishing its meal, the 33,000-pound beast slithered out ahead of the pack, its brood falling into formation behind her. After nearly 30 minutes, Ivan had outlined a furrow around the mysterious object, measuring almost 8 feet long and 5 feet across. There was still no telling how deep the object was buried. Terry saw the radio operator jump.
She watched his face go pale.
Captain, the Benthus reports unidentified bioforms moving in our direction.
Everything stopped. Everyone on board looked at Benedict.
How close?
The captain said.
5 kilometers due west and closing fast. ETA, 19 minutes. The Benthos is 13 minutes southeast.
Continue digging, Benedict ordered. We cannot and will not tear apart the vacuum.
The crew looked from Benedict to the captain.
You heard Mr. Singer's orders,
the captain yelled.
So now, let us know when these life forms appear on your screen. Chief, alert the Benthos that...
Captain, 4 objects now on my screen,
Sonar called out. Computer indicates the life forms to be...
Jesus, they're half the size of the Prometheus. Sir, they've increased speed. ETA now 14 minutes.
The captain turned to Benedict.
Sir, we have to abandon the vacuum.
Are you suffering from hearing loss, Captain?
No, sir.
Perhaps a lack of nerve, then?
No, sir. My concern is not for myself, but for my crew.
Here I am. Here I shall remain until the task at hand is completed.
ETA, 10 minutes,
Sonar reported.
Bantha still 12 minutes away,
the radio man said. Terry took her seat by the computer station, her heart pounding.
God damn you, Benedict. Why are you doing this? Is this a macho thing to show all of us how tough you really are? Or do you just get off on toying with everyone's emotions?
She gripped the armrest, frustrated at finding her life once again resting in his hands.
I'm underneath the object,
Ivan reported. Benedict looked down into the pod.
Can you raise it? I'll try.
Ivan began retracting the hydraulic arms. Terry pressed her face to the window. She could see an enormous black object dispersing bucket loads of sediment as it rose from its primordial burial ground. Several long minutes passed while the mechanical arms struggled to withdraw their prize.
1 minute, Captain.
Vacuum's free, Benedict,
Ivan reported.
Should I release the object?
Yes,
the captain said.
No,
Benedict yelled.
Secure the object beneath the sub.
Terry felt claustrophobic. The walls of the submersible seemed to be closing in. She thought of the Proteus, how the slightest breach in the integrity of its hull would have caused it to implode.
Object secured,
Ivan said.
You may take us to the Benthos, Captain,
Benedict ordered. Terry held on as the sub dropped, rolling to port.
God damn it!
The captain squeezed his way forward to the ballast controls.
What the hell is that thing, Ivan? Must weigh over 500 pounds!
The captain released ballast, the sub righting itself.
Sir, 2 lifeforms off the port bow, the other circling, range 50 meters. I think they mean to channel us away from the Benthos.
Terry pressed her face to the glass. She could see nothing but blackness.
Benthos now within view, Captain,
a relieved chief shouted.
Life forms moving away, distancing themselves.
The captain smiled nervously.
The Benthos is too big to pick a fight with. Chief, request hangar doors be opened. Maneuver the Prometheus into position to deposit the object we've extracted from the seafloor. Then prepare the sub for docking.
Terry breathed a sigh of relief. She released her grip from the armrest and whispered a prayer of thanks. Then she remembered Sergei was waiting for her on board. Trapped. SeaWorld, Seattle, Washington. SeaWorld Animal Care Supervisor Pete Soderblom sneaked a peek at the gathering crowd from behind the auditorium's backstage curtains.
Christ, Andy, what the hell's going on? It's like a media feeding frenzy out there.
Zoologist Andrew Furman handed him the newspaper.
Take a look at the front page.
Pete scanned the headlines of the Seattle Times. Escaped Megalodon sighted off Ledbetter Point. Oysterville, Washington. Carcharodon Megalodon, the 72-foot monster shark that only days earlier attacked a Coast Guard vessel, killing 2, was sighted by fishermen off Ledbetter Point early yesterday evening. We were heading in when this huge white dorsal fin started circling the boat, said Cal Cambron, a local fisherman. Damn thing followed us right into the bay before heading out to sea. Scared the hell out of the entire crew. Our boat's only a 50-footer. In a related story, scientists at SeaWorld report that Tootie, the 18,000-pound gray whale calf released into the wild weeks earlier, appears to have abandoned its attempts to migrate north to the Bering Sea. The newborn, which had beached itself 4 months earlier along ocean shores, was spotted feeding in Gray's Harbor yesterday by whale watchers. Biologists at SeaWorld, tracking the calf's movements by radio transmitter, confirmed Tootie's position to be less than 25 miles from where the megalodon was last sighted. Animal rights activist Gay Gordon expressed concern that the newborn whale was in danger. While we commend SeaWorld for saving Tootie's life, we believe that officials should have delayed the calf's return to the wild until after the megalodon's recapture.
Pete Soderblom, SeaWorld's animal care supervisor, could not be reached for comment.
"This is horseshit," yelled Pete. "I was in the office all night and no one called, and this reporter doesn't even mention the fact that we released Tootie at least a week before the Megalodon even escaped. How the hell were we supposed to know?"
"Forget that, Pete. We've got bigger problems," Andrew said.
"I spoke with Jonas Taylor about an hour ago. He's tracking the Megalodon aboard the William Beebe and confirmed that the creature could reach Gray's Harbor within 3 hours. We have to face the reality that the Meg could enter the bay and slaughter the calf."
Pete wiped sweat from his brow. "Christ, we're looking at a public relations disaster."
"I got a call this morning from Anheuser-Busch, and to put it lightly, they are not happy campers. Apparently, associating beer with a defenseless whale calf being eaten by a 70-foot shark is not what they had in mind for their new Back to Nature campaign. Pete, we need to get down to Gray's Harbor with the tractor trailer and get her out of there."
"Are you certain Tootie's still in the bay?"
"According to our last radio fix. Why? What are you thinking?"
Pete smiled.
"If the Megalodon does enter Gray's Harbor to go after the calf, we could use some gill nets to seal off its exit and trap it within the bay. In fact, we could coordinate the Megalodon's capture with Tootie's rescue."
"You ought to use Tootie as bait?"
"Unfortunately, her presence near the Megalodon makes her bait. But picture this. Tootie's safe in the cargo truck. The Megalodon's been captured, thanks to SeaWorld, and we're all celebrating with a cold one. Think I could sell that to Anheuser-Busch?"
"Beats the hell out of Spuds McKenzie. What do you want me to do?"
"Arrange for the cargo container and harness to rendezvous with us at the Westport Marina. That truck needs to be on the highway within the next hour. I'll set up a conference call between Jonas Taylor, myself, and the harbormaster. We need to minimize boating traffic and see if there are any gill nets available to seal off the mouth of the bay."
"What about the calf?"
"When you contact Westport Marina, rent us a fishing trawler, complete with nets. We'll locate Tootie and drag her into the shallow water before the monster can get to her. Once she's safe, we'll either wait it out or transport her back to SeaWorld, depending upon what happens with the Meg."
"We'll need a crane, then."
Andrew motioned to the auditorium.
"Don't forget about the press."
"I'll handle them. In fact, I'll brief them regarding our intentions. Then I want to speak with Jonas Taylor."
Jonas shielded his eyes against flying debris as the helicopter touched down on the helipad of the William Beebe. He waited until the rotors stopped before greeting Mac. Mac slid out of the chopper and looked Jonas up and down.
"You seem to have recovered well. Guess you have your private nurse to thank for that."
"What's that supposed to mean?" Jonas asked.
"We need to talk, pal, but not here. Give me a hand. I've got the equipment you requested in back."
Mac led him to the cargo bay. He slid open the door, revealing two wooden crates, each marked Tanaka Oceanographic Institute. Mac opened the first crate, removing a bizarre-looking rifle.
"One Olin Ram rocket-boosted rifle grenade. It's not bulky like a Laws rocket, and it can be launched from the muzzle of any NATO standard rifle."
"Yes, but is it capable of killing an animal this size with one shot?"
"Hell yes. The charge was designed to go through 400 millimeters of armor at a range of 250 meters. One good shot broadside, and your shark is fricassee."
"What's inside this other crate?"
"A portable acoustics transmitter, tape recorder, and a set of underwater microphones."
"Planning a deep-sea concert?"
"More like an underwater dinner bell. Let's leave the grenade rifle inside. We'll stow the sound equipment in the stern."
They carried the crate aft, locking it in one of the storage compartments adjacent to the ship's A-frame. "So, talk to me, Mac. What's on your mind?" Mac stared out at the Washington coastline.
"Explain to me why you have a death wish."
"A death wish?"
"Don't play me for stupid."
"I have a death wish because I jumped in after that cadet?
What was I supposed to do? Stand there and watch him get eaten?" "You didn't just go in after him. You went in with reckless abandon, like you didn't give a shit if you lived or died."
Jonas spat into the sea.
"I recognize the symptoms, Jonas. I've been there myself. You're suffering from a classic case of survivor's guilt."
"I already have a psychiatrist."
"Now you have two. I guess you're forgetting that I went through the same thing in Nam."
"How is this the same?"
"Hey, pal, no one volunteers for a third tour of duty unless their brain's been seriously fucked up. Third week I was in the jungle, I led my platoon straight into a gook ambush. Lost more than half my men. I blamed myself, just like you. Hell, I must have relived that night in my dreams 1,000 times.
"Do you still have the dreams?"
"Once in a while, but they're nowhere near as intense. I don't wake up screaming anymore."
Mac put his arm on Jonas's shoulder.
"You're going through the same shit I went through, except you've declared war on this creature. Of course, the creature don't know it, being just a dumb animal trying to survive, but you... Hell, you're as obsessed as Captain fucking Ahab. You blame the last 11 years of your life and everything you've lost on this monster, and you won't be satisfied until you kill it." I didn't realize all those sessions in the loony bin had taught you so much.
Joke if you like, just don't be so quick to throw your life away. Just because you can't see the forest for the trees right now doesn't mean you won't find your way out. I did, and I was in deep.
I know the way out. I've seen the way my life ends.
They're just nightmares, Jonas. I used to dream about getting killed all the time, too. Don't turn them into a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I'm not trying to, believe me. Bullshit.
Max slapped him playfully across his head.
Jumping in to rescue that cadet? Who are you, fucking Batman?
Jonas smiled.
Okay, that was a tad risky.
Yeah, a tad.
So these nightmares are yours. How does it happen, your death?
Jonas looked Mac in the eye. I'm in the Abyss Glider, descending to the Mariana Trench. For some reason, I seem to be searching for Terry.
Terry's in the trench?
Yes. She dies with me right after I find her. Mac slumped down onto the deck.
What?
Mac leaned back against the rail.
I was waiting to tell you. When I stopped by the Institute to pick up your toys, I was told Maceo suffered a heart attack.
The blood drained from Jonas's face.
When?
Yesterday afternoon. Sadia found him unconscious in his office. They transported him to Valley Memorial. The doctor says he's stable, but he was still unconscious when I stopped by to see him. He looked pretty bad.
I need to call the hospital. Has anyone contacted Terry?
Mac averted eye contact.
Now what?
Mac looked pale.
There's more. Maceo had just received word that your wife descended into the Mariana Trench with Benedict Singer. She's aboard the Benthos.
Jonas took it like a punch in the gut. His eyes shut, all the strength drained from his body.
Jonas, she'll be okay.
Jonas shook his head.
It's happening, Mac. My nightmare is playing itself out like some bizarre deja vu. Terry and I will both end up in the trench. The creature will appear at...
Take it easy, pal.
Jonas became enraged.
I begged Terry not to go. God damn it, I begged her.
Mac stood, grabbing him by the arm. Jonas, listen to me. Terry will be back on board the Goliath in a few days, and the Megalodon is thousands of miles from the trench. Thousands of miles. Don't let your guilt fuck with you. Terry descending into the trench is just a coincidence. I'm telling you, she'll be topside by the end of the week.
I don't know anymore. I can't think rationally. Maybe that's all it is, just a coincidence, but I can't take a chance. I need to kill this fucking monster and remove all doubt.
Agreed. Once the shark's dead, you and Terry will ride off into the sunset. Jonas exhaled a deep breath.
You're assuming, of course, that she'll still have me.
She'll have you. You guys were meant to be together.
Mac looked up to see Celeste approaching.
Just stay away from the temptations of the wicked queen.
Why don't you do us all a favor and fly that bucket of bolts back to Vietnam? Celeste said.
Mac smiled at her.
Beats the hell out of flying a broomstick.
Will the two of you knock it off?
Celeste turned to Jonas.
I came to tell you that one of the directors over at SeaWorld is on the radio. He says he knows how he can trap the Meg.
Jonas spread the chart of the Pacific Northwest out on the light table, circling Grace Harbor with a red erasable marker. According to SeaWorld, the calf they released has taken up residence here in Grace Harbor. If the Meg stays on her present course, she'll detect the calf and home in on her. SeaWorld's plan is for us to follow the Megalodon into the bay. Once inside, the harbor master would drop the gill nets into place across the inlet, which will hang vertically under the sea like giant curtains. The depth in this area is only 50 to 60 feet, the inlet about 3 miles across. The Meg would literally be confined within the bay.
Sounds good, Celeste said.
It's not going to be easy. There's also some financial considerations. Before Westport Marina moves their fishing vessels into place to spread the nets, they want Geotech to guarantee to pay for any and all damages incurred, plus an additional $10,000 to cover labor and expenses. Celeste scoffed.
They should be paying us for the publicity we'll be bringing to their damn harbor. What do you think, Madden?
I say do it. We'll never get another opportunity like this. The costs involved are a drop in the bucket compared to what the Institute's losing every day.
She looked at Jonas.
Do you agree?
The plan could work, but it's risky as hell. We're not allowing the harbor police much time to clear away boating traffic.
I disagree, Marin said. Sosus indicates the Megalodon to be less than 2 miles ahead, moving north at only 3 knots. At her present speed, she won't even arrive at the mouth of the bay for another 94 minutes.
Jonas scoffed. Let me tell you something, Marin. The moment Angel detects that calf, she'll be racing through the ocean like a runaway freight train. Her top speed's 68 miles an hour, so you better get that slide rule of yours back out and rethink this whole plan. My vote is to keep this battle at sea. Cornering any animal, let alone a 72-foot great white, is a dangerous proposition. Angel spent her entire life in captivity. She's not going to be real happy about being confined again.
I remember when the first shark went berserk off the coast of Monterey,
Max said. Plenty of boats went down that afternoon. A lot of people died.
Marin rolled his eyes in disgust.
We're wasting time. The harbor master is waiting for our call.
This whole discussion seems moot, Celeste said. Like it or not, there's a good chance the creature is going to detect this baby whale and go after it. If it enters the bay, we'd be foolish not to attempt to capture it there.
Finally, a voice of reason.
Marin grabbed the radio to contact the harbor master. Captain Morgan studied the map.
The inlet may be narrow, but Gray's Harbor is huge. Harpooning that monster once she enters won't be very easy. We still have to find her. Sosus will be useless to us once we're in the bay.
The bay's shallow, Jonas said. Mac and I should be able to spot her from the air.
Just locate the baby whale and the Angel will follow, Celeste said.
SeaWorld just radioed, Marin said. Their rescue team has arrived in Hoquiam. They should be heading out into the bay aboard a fishing trawler within the next 20 minutes.
Celeste turned to him.
Tell them not to remove the calf before the creature enters.
SeaWorld's first priority is to save the calf, Jonas said. In my opinion, they're already cutting it close. I'm telling you, once Angel homes in on that whale, she'll enter the bay faster than you think.
Well, if she does, it'll be arrivederci tutti, Celeste said.
Doesn't matter, Marin said. As long as the wolf enters the pen, who cares if it happens to eat the sheep?
Mac shook his head.
You can bet your ass the sheep cares.
The gray whale calf, known to SeaWorld as Tootie, continued plowing the muddy bottom of Gray's Harbor. Unable to keep up with the other migrating whales, the calf had sought shelter in the bay, attracted by the vast quantities of food located along the seabed. Sucking the turbid water into its mouth, the calf filtered out sandhopper and other bottom-living organisms from the silt through its baleen before sucking the food to the back of its throat. After several minutes, Tootie would rise back to the surface to blow, then inhale another breath before returning to feed again along the bottom. The predator moved silently along the seafloor, its bioluminescent skin casting a dull glow along the murky bottom. Baleful eyes, cataract gray, searched the sea in vain for an object its primal senses insisted was somewhere ahead. Short, powerful sweeps of the crescent tail propelled the giant into a higher gear. Soaring in from behind its darting prey, the leviathan rolled onto its side and opened its jaws, creating a vacuum of sea that sucked a 6-foot octopus and its inky trail down into its immense gullet. Swallowing the morsel whole, the shark righted itself, its bulk sailing effortlessly along the bottom. Once more the predator slowed, returning to automatic pilot, its senses keeping it on the trail of the migrating whale pods. 200 yards to the south, 7 predators, ranging from 14 to 22 feet in length, reduced their speed almost as one. Aroused by the intense scent of their primordial cousin, the male great whites had continued to follow the gigantic female as she made her way north, feeding off the remains of her kills, yet always remaining a safe distance behind. Moving at a velocity just above stall speed, the megalodon entered a state of rest as close to sleep as nature would allow. The rogue hunter knew the males were shadowing her, having registered their presence ever since she had escaped the lagoon. With prey readily available, the female tolerated the sharks, provided they moved no closer. As the megalodon coasted along the bottom, distant vibrations coursing along the seafloor began stimulating nerve fibers along the creature's flank. Rapid signals were transmitted to its brain, activating a primeval alarm. Aroused from its stupor, the megalodon's posture changed. Rapid movements of its head and snout engaged its olfactory sense. Breathing the sea, the monster shark isolated the direction of the whale calf's scent. Like a guided missile, the planet's fiercest predator raced across the ocean floor, stirring great gusts of sediment in its wake. Pete Soderblom followed his acoustic specialist across a long boardwalk owned by the Westport Marina, home to one of the largest commercial fishing fleets in the area. The vantage offered him a panoramic view of the entire harbor. Directly ahead loomed the Gray's Harbor Lighthouse, rising 107 feet in the air. Just to its left was the Pacific Ocean, connected to the bay by way of a 3-mile inlet. From here, Gray's Harbor opened to a vast expanse of shallow water, stretching to the north and east as far as the eye could see. 9 cities dotted its banks, along with 4 modern marine terminals equipped to handle even the largest cargo ships in the world. A police escort assisted them in getting through the crowd. Officers instructed fishermen to reel in their lines as thousands of onlookers jostled for positions along the pedestrian esplanade. Hundreds more stood on viewing platforms, a lucky few even managing to reserve vantages from the marina's 3-story observation tower. Brown pelicans balanced on pilings. Sandpipers and blue herons strutted along the water's edge. Heavy bass from a calypso beat mixed with the cawing of seabirds, and the aroma of fast food, all adding to the carnival atmosphere. The police officer led Pete and his technician down a long fishing pier, where hundreds of empty boats floated in their berths. The bright silver surface of the sea sparkled up at him, forcing him to squint. Normally a mecca of activity, the bay was now off-limits to all but the harbor patrol and two fishing trawlers, which, at that moment, were moving into position at the center of the inlet. Pete noticed another fishing trawler tied at the end of the pier. Over 90 feet in length, the trawler's deck was an open expanse used for hauling in nets filled with massive quantities of fish. With the exception of the pilot house, the only other prominent features of the trawler were three steel, arch-like buttresses rising 20 feet above the deck. These overhead structures supported two steel cables that ran from the fishing nets across the top of the arches, then into two hydraulic winches situated behind the pilot house. Once the nets were full, the cables would be hauled in, dragging the trawl up the angled stern deck, directly from the sea to the ship's hold. Pete climbed aboard and spotted Andrew Furman speaking with a deeply tanned, very tall man in his late 30s.
"Pete, this is Greg DiChiaro, the ship's captain. He says Tootie's been seen feeding about a mile out."
"Great. How soon till we're underway?"
"My crew should be finished rigging the trawl net within the next 10 minutes. How much this whale here's weigh?"
"I'd estimate 19,000 pounds, Pete said. "Can your rig handle that?"
"Long as she don't thrash about too much. What I told your assistant here is we'll use the otter trawl. The net itself is weighted, so it'll spread open like a giant parachute when we tow it. We'll scoop your whale up and then drag her to shore."
Andrew pointed to the shoreline, where a 30-foot harness dangled from an immense crane.
"That's where we need to be. The cargo container's already in place and partially filled with seawater."
Pete glanced up at the growing crowd.
"I have a feeling these people didn't just come out here to watch a whale being rescued."
He checked his watch nervously.
"I think we'd better go get our calf."
Jonas watched Dr. Marin replot the latest SOSUS coordinates for the fourth time in 5 minutes.
"Is there a problem?"
he asked. Marin looked up at Jonas, ashen-faced.
I think you were right."
He shook his head in disbelief.
"Where is she?"
"According to these coordinates, she just entered the bay."
"God damn it!"
Jonas grabbed the radio.
"Andy, come in!"
A voice bathed in static said,
"Go ahead, Jonas."
"Andy, the Megalodon just entered the bay. Have you netted Tootie yet?"
"Jonas, repeat, please. It sounded as if you said the creature's already in the bay."
"Affirmative. Have you netted your whale?"
"No, not yet, but we've closed to within 200 yards. Stand by."
Pete stood in the pilot house scanning the bay through a pair of high-power binoculars. His acoustics man was to his right, listening to the dual transmitters fastened along Tootie's upper torso.
"She should be just ahead of us,"
the man said.
"Both signals still coming in loud and clear."
Pete saw a lead-gray head break the water, the snout covered in kelp.
"There she is, directly ahead."
The captain signaled for the otter trawl to be released. Seconds later, the net began feeding out behind the ship. Bobbing along the surface, Tootie scooped kelp into her mouth, using her baleen to strain the myriad of tiny sea creatures attached to the long leaves. Swallowing the morsels, the gray calf took another breath and submerged. Descending gracefully through the murk, the newborn suddenly registered another presence, closing quickly. The calf stopped swimming. A luminescent blur streaked toward her along the seafloor. Sensing danger, the calf turned, retreating to the surface. Pete watched his radio technician frantically adjust the acoustics receiver.
"Damn it, I just lost one of the transmitters,"
the technician said.
"The other's functioning, but the strength of the signal just dropped in half. Tootie's moving away from the bottom about 100 yards off the starboard bow."
"Pete, Jonas says the Megalodon has entered the bay,"
Andy reported.
"We gotta get Tootie out of the water now."
"Give me the whale's exact location,"
the captain ordered.
"One click to starboard,"
the technician said.
"That's good, we're right in line. She's still deep, we'll pass over. Now."
The captain made a slight course adjustment, then cut his speed in half.
"Got her!"
yelled the technician, slapping Pete's high five. Seconds later, the entire ship shuddered as the otter trawl scooped up an immense life form.
"Taking the slack, boys!"
the captain ordered his crew. The two hydraulic winches strained to haul in the submerged load. The William Beebe slipped into Gray's Harbor as the last 100 yards of gill net was dropped into position across the inlet. Jonas ducked beneath the whirling rotors of the helicopter and climbed in.
"Did you ready the weapon?"
"All set," Max said. "Hold on."
The chopper lifted away from the deck, soaring out ahead of the ship. Jonas found the Olin Ram rifle grenade hidden beneath a pile of blankets. Verifying a grenade was already loaded into the barrel, he returned to his seat with the weapon. Mac handed him the radio.
"SeaWorld." "Andy?"
"Jonas, we just bagged our whale. We're towing her in now, but she's really struggling. The Meg must be circling close by."
Jonas could hear men yelling in the background.
Stand by, Andy.
The chopper flew over the trawler, hovering at 200 feet. Jonah saw the submerged net, as well as an ivory shape at the midst of what appeared to be a battle raging below the surface.
Andy, the Meg's right behind you. Haul in the calf!
Pete stood next to the trawler's captain and a dozen of his crew, watching as the fishing net was slowly hauled up from the bay along the steep incline at the stern. The ship shuddered, the incline actually dipping deeper into the water.
God damn it! The captain swore. The girders are bending. No way this calf only weighs 9 tons.
Andy ran over to them, out of breath.
Jonah says the Meg's right behind us. We've got to haul Tootie on board.
The captain grabbed him by the arm and pointed above their heads.
See that? We pull any harder and those arches will collapse.
Black smoke billowed across the deck.
Now what?
The captain yelled.
Smells like the goddamn bearings are burning up.
The trawler continued shuddering, the engines unable to push the ship forward. A high-pitched metallic screech rent the air.
Kill the engines,
the captain ordered. Incredibly, the stern began dipping into the sea, the water level rising to within 4 feet of the transom. Pete braced himself, staring down the steep incline, praying for Tootie to emerge from the sea. The calf was putting up a terrific struggle. The stern suddenly righted, the strain on the cables momentarily easing. The trawl net began rising.
Here she comes,
Pete announced, making his way down the ramp as if to greet his whale. Angel's ghostly white face rose vertically out of the bay, her mouth stretched open as if the creature were screaming. Tootie's scarlet blood outlined the jaws like smudged lipstick. Shards of whale blubber dangled from murderous rows of teeth. Angel's upper torso, entangled in fishing net, remained suspended clear out of the water, up to her wing-like pectoral fins. Pete's eyes bugged out, horrified, yet mesmerized by the size of the beast. Pinned against the transom, too heavy to be hauled aboard, the monster remained upright in the water, one of its gray eyes locked on the trawler. Then, with unfathomable power, the megalodon began twisting her ensnared upper torso from side to side in violent spasms. Each jolt caused the fishing trawler to lurch, tightening the stranglehold of netting across the creature's body. Enraged, the beast fought harder, each sweeping movement of her colossal head exaggerated in great, arcing movements, back and forth along the surface, her fury rolling towering swells of ocean in every direction. Pete could only hold on as tons of churning water and shards of fishing net splattered on his head. He heard a sickening groan of steel, followed by men yelling, as the forward support arches collapsed onto the deck. Jonas and Mac stared at the surreal scene below.
God, what a monster, Mac whispered.
She's tearing the vessel apart. Jonas positioned the grenade rifle onto his shoulder. Mac, get us closer. It's time to end this nightmare. The chopper dropped, hovering 40 feet above the trawler. Jonas aimed.
Damn it. She's thrashing too much to get off a clean shot.
At that moment, one of the two steel cables supporting the trawl net tore loose from its hydraulic winch, the free ends sent lashing through the air. Striking the back of the helicopter, it shredded the whirling rotors from the tail assembly.
What the fuck was that?
Mac yelled.
Shit, I'm losing control!
The chopper began twirling in dizzying circles. The remaining cable tore loose, splaying across the deck. It struck one of the crewmen across his elbow, severing his arm in two, then caught itself around the remaining steel support in the stern. Spinning out of control, Mac lost altitude and plummeted toward the deck of the trawler. Jonas held his breath as the landing struts collapsed onto the remains of one of the ravaged steel supports, the airship nearly toppling overboard before coming to rest on the pile of mangled metal. With a final sweep of its head, the megalodon's sharp denticles shredded the remains of the bonds along its upper torso, allowing the shark to fall back beneath the surf. Pete scrambled up the slick incline in time to see the helicopter crash on deck. Andy reached down and grabbed his hand.
Where's Tootie?
Pete struggled to catch his breath.
That monster must have eaten her, transmitter and all.
Oh, fuck.
Look at my ship,
the captain yelled.
Who the hell's gonna pay for this?
The trawler lurched backward, knocking everyone off their feet.
Jesus Christ, now what?
Andrew yelled. Pete stared at the stern. Waves sloshed against the incline as the trawler was pulled back through the sea.
I don't believe this, Pete said. The thing's towing us.
The captain spotted the end of the remaining cable wound around the stern support. He ran to the pilot house and grabbed an axe. As he braced himself to sever the cable, the line suddenly snapped, the enraged animal tearing itself free from the last of its bonds. The William Beebe churned slowly across the inlet, patrolling the 3-mile stretch of bay now cordoned off from the ocean by the vertically hanging gill nets. 600 pounds of half-frozen, rotting whale blubber floated 40 feet behind her, attached by a steel cable to the big winch in the stern. Harry Moon peered over the top of the harpoon gun, staring at the trailing flesh. With one hand, he nervously fingered the trigger of the weapon. With the other, he held a portable headset to his ear.
Deep, what's happening up there?
Standing precariously atop a slender steel grate 5 stories above the deck, Richard Diefendorf held onto the central mast as he focused his binoculars on the bay.
Looks like she's freed herself of the trawler. I can't see... Wait! There's the dorsal fin. Harry, stand ready. She's heading this way. Captain, we need to be farther south. Another 200 yards.
Listening on his own headset, Captain Morgan relayed the instructions to his helmsman.
Celeste, Dr. Marin, Deef says she's coming,
Harry reported. Standing along the portside rail, Celeste and Dr. Marin searched the sea, waiting for the alabaster hide of the Megalodon to show itself. Deef spotted her first.
Captain, she's 60 yards off the port bow and closing fast. I can't tell which. Oh, wait, she's breaking toward the stern.
Let's give Mr. Moon his shot, the captain said. Helm, all engines stop.
Angel streaked along the muddy bottom, close to exhaustion. Although the denticles along her rough hide had minimized the damage from the trawl net, veils of blood trailed from her head and abdomen, where razor-like lacerations now zigzagged across her shiny, pale skin. Self-preservation was now the creature's overriding instinct. Vulnerable in the shallows, she headed for deeper water, racing toward the inlet. Having detected the object at the surface, the Megalodon hugged the seafloor to avoid another confrontation. Somewhere ahead in the murky water came the death throes of 2 of the male great whites, both having become hopelessly entangled in the gill net. Sensing the dangerous obstruction, the Meg banked sharply, whipping its head away from the barrier as it soared along the netting, searching for a way out.
The shark's moving south along the net, looking to escape,
Deef reported.
She's ignoring the bait,
Harry said.
And she's way too deep for me to take a shot.
Deef followed the blur with his binoculars until the behemoth raced out of sight.
This is impossible. We need the chopper. What the hell's Mac doing?
Mac and Jonas covered their eyes as the Harbor Patrol helicopter landed on the deck of the disabled trawler. The wounded crewman was quickly loaded on board, his severed arm in a plastic garbage bag packed in ice.
We'll send another chopper for you boys as soon as we can,
the co-pilot shouted as the airship lifted. The trawler captain waited until the noise of the rotors dissipated before starting in on Jonas and Pete Soderblom again.
That otter trawl will cost you $100,000, he yelled. And there's no telling how much damage was done to my engines.
Captain, relax, Max said. I'm a witness. I heard Celeste Singer agree to pay for all damages. Geotech is more money than they know what to do with. If I were you, I'd sue the shit out of them.
Jonas ignored them, focusing on the harbor through binoculars. Captain, what is that? He pointed north. A tall wooden sailing ship was heading toward them. The captain stared at the object with his own binoculars.
That's the Lady Washington, a replica of an 18th-century tall ship.
Yeah, but what's the boat doing in the bay? Andy, you better get the harbormaster on the radio.
The Meg's coming around, heading right for us,
Deef shouted.
Harry, I can see the tip of her caudal fin. She's just below the surface. Captain, she'll pass under us on our starboard side within 30 seconds. Give her some room.
Dr. Marin rushed over to Harry Moon.
Take the shot. It may be the only one you get.
Harry spun the gun around, the point of the harpoon facing the open ocean. He stared down the barrel, waiting for the shark to appear behind the ship. Deef held his breath, watching the pale shadow streaking just below the surface.
Damn it, she's sounding.
There she is,
Marin pointed, excited by the sheer size of the creature gliding beneath the boat. Harry saw the cream-colored object sail by. He fired. The harpoon exploded from the gun with a loud bang, trailing steel cable through a cloud of silver smoke. The Meg was in 60 feet of water when the point of the harpoon struck the base of her dorsal fin. Slowed by the sea, the lance lacked the power required to pierce deep enough into the shark's thick skin. Registering the attack, the Megalodon twisted along the bottom, shaking the harpoon from its hide before the anesthetic could be delivered. Cornered and wounded, the animal went berserk. Uninvited guest. Captain James H. Locke, known to friends and crew merely as Flag, stood on the poop deck of the Lady Washington, nodding to the guests of the bride and groom as the ship's pursers led them to their seats. He felt a cool spring breeze at his back, watching as the wind filled the square-rigged main and foresails that stretched out high above his head. The Douglas fir brig, Lady Washington, was a full-size reproduction of an 18th-century tall ship, the first American flag vessel ever to sail around Cape Horn. She had an overall length of 112 feet and a 24-foot beam, and her 2 masts, each containing 3 sails, towered 87 feet above the main deck. Normally at this time of day, Washington State's tall ship ambassador could be found at port, offering dockside tours to the public. On this particular afternoon, however, the Lady Washington had been privately chartered to host a wedding ceremony, a fact not realized by the harbormaster. Three bells signaled 1:30. The guests quieted. Flag waited, listening to the calming sounds of the sea and the comfort